What was Aragorn's tax policy? We're told that he was a good king, but what does that actually mean? What policies did he pursue once he had absolute power? Let's take a look. Hi everyone, this is Robert. Welcome to In Deep Geek. Here we cover The Lord of the Rings, A Song of Ice and Fire, and much more. If you love in-depth discussion of great fantasy and science fiction, welcome. And yes, this is a re-upload for various reasons. If you've seen it before, feel free to skip it. George R. R. Martin is well known as a huge fan of J.R.R. Tolkien. He loves Middle-earth and The Lord of the Rings and rereads the books most years, but like all good friends, is never slow in offering constructive feedback. Here's what he said about Aragorn as king. "Ruling is hard." This was maybe my answer to Tolkien, whom, as much as I admire him, I do quibble with. The Lord of the Rings had a very medieval philosophy, that if the king was a good man, the land would prosper. We look at real history and it's not that simple. Tolkien can say that Aragorn became king and reigned for 100 years and he was wise and good, but Tolkien doesn't ask the question, what was Aragorn's tax policy? Did he maintain a standing army? What did he do in times of flood and famine? These are all fair critiques. Tolkien, of course, didn't write extensively about what happened after The Lord of the Rings, so perhaps he did have an answer and just never wrote it down. And he's obviously not now in a position to defend himself, but he did leave a wealth of notes, essays, and other scribbles that his son Christopher and others have preserved for us. So let's look at what he did tell us and see whether we can patch together an understanding of what Aragorn was like as a king. Was he actually a good king? What did he do? And crucially, what was his tax policy? Well, let's start with the nerdily wonderful subject of governance structures. When we think of a king, we often think of a ruler with unlimited powers, able to do whatever they wanted, a sort of Henry VIII figure, above the law, able to hire, fire, and behead people as they wish, even declaring war on a whim or setting up a new state religion or whatever. This, however, is not the situation with Aragorn in Middle-earth. His was not an absolute rulership. Aragorn, or Elessar as was his kingly name, was High King over the United Kingdoms of Gondor and Arnor. And yes, although this made him the highest power in the realm, the government structure which was established for Numenorean kings and carried on into Middle-earth meant one very important distinction that prevented him from being a dictator. He must always act under the law, Numenorean law. He did not have the power to create new law or change ancient laws. He couldn't just do whatever he wanted. He was constrained by law. This is how Tolkien described the situation. What you need to know is that Aragorn very much styled himself and ruled as a king of Numenorean descent. So with that in mind, this is how Tolkien described Aragorn's kingship. A Numenorean king was monarch, with the power of unquestioned decision in debate. But he governed the realm with the frame of ancient law, of which he was administrator and interpreter, but not maker. So this is what we might today call a constitutional monarchy, in which Aragorn respected the constitution and didn't just do what he wanted. That's part of what he understood being a good ruler meant. And as part of this, Aragorn had an obligation to take on board the advice of the Council of Gondor, which was formed of the Lords of the Fiefs and Captains of the Forces of Gondor. In other words, the ruling lords who paid fealty to Minas Tirith and the military commanders. Chief among whom was the steward of Gondor, Faramir, for many years after the War of the Ring. There are others we know as well, like Imrahil, Prince of Dol Amroth. This Council of Gondor knew the power of its role. Once, back in the middle of the Third Age, they even decided on who should be king during a succession crisis, and of course the stewards held the rulership of Gondor for many centuries in the absence of a king. In the Northern Kingdom, Arnor, which Aragorn's predecessors ruled, there was also a council. We know fewer details about this, although as Aragorn seems to have spent most of his time in the south, we can assume that they, or some other group, were in charge of day-to-day management of the kingdom there after he became king. So Numenorean kings and Aragorn, as the inheritor of that legacy, were constrained by laws they must uphold and cannot change, and the advice they receive from their councils. In practice, of course, Aragorn also tacitly ruled by agreement of his lords, and each of those lords ruled their own lands. He just adjudicated on matters that affected everyone, or on which people couldn't agree. Take Gondor, for example. There were a dozen or more different fiefs or regions, the exact number changed over time, each ruled by a lord or a prince or such like, and each was largely autonomous. The ruler of each fief ruled in that land. They were responsible for justice and leadership and taxation, and Aragorn seems to have largely left them to it. Aragorn, as High King, was responsible for the reunited kingdom as a whole, not governance at a local level. Okay, so that's the structure Aragorn was working within. Ultimate ruler, but a long way short of absolute power. In this context, it's easy to understand Tolkien's implicit assumption that the most important factor in whether a nation prospered or suffered was the character of their ruler. The system itself completely supported this. A ruler of noble character would take wise advice and honour their place as upholder of the law, which had come from great Numenor itself. And of course, the country would prosper. We do have to point out that this is an inherently conservative method of government and way of thinking. Conservative with a small c, that is. There is an institutionalised barrier against change. Millennia-old laws are there to be interpreted and upheld, not changed in the light of new circumstances. And powerful families stay powerful, and powerless families stay powerless. This isn't a particularly egalitarian or democratic way of ruling. But anyway, what did Aragorn actually do? What policies did he pursue? Well, he spent quite a bit of time on foreign policy. He invaded Umbar and led successful campaigns across the continent. He forged peace with the Haradrim and spent a lot of time rooting out Orc enclaves. We should note that the other part of George R. R. Martin's critique of Aragorn's rulership, other than the question of tax policy, was to question whether he killed all the Orc babies. Perhaps Aragorn was quite ruthless in this, but I did another video on that if you're interested. To Aragorn, his military campaigns were mostly about securing peace for the people that he ruled, and he achieved that. The land was at peace, and the people prospered from it. More reassuringly, King Elessar seems to have been proactively anti-slavery, freeing the slaves that had been in Mordor and granting them land and freedom. We're told that he respected the self-determination of two culturally different parts of his kingdom, the Shire, extending its borders in the process, and the Druidan Forest, home to the Woses, who had played a small but significant part in the War of the Ring. They were both granted the status of protective enclaves within the kingdom, being allowed to rule themselves without outside interference. We also read about Aragorn repairing Minas Tirith, pretty lavishly, it seems, with the Great Gate being remade of mithril and steel and the streets paved with white marble. All in all, Aragorn's rule seems to have brought peace, stability, the rule of law, secure borders, and clear leadership. The fact that the people prospered as a result seems hardly surprising. But what about tax? Well, the big problem we have is that whereas Tolkien talked a lot about languages, legends, and so on, he hardly ever covered economics, at least not directly. But do not worry, amateur economists, as we all know, public spending and private spending is about the economy, so we can definitely delve into it a bit more here. Money does definitely exist as a medium of exchange in Middle-earth, and trade seems to happen between cultures and peoples, albeit not on a massive scale. We see tax being raised and public money being spent. Tolkien's alleged indifference to the economy is perhaps there, but even he knew, subconsciously at least, that a fully realised world needed at least a partly realised economy. Simply put, Aragorn needed money to pay for his soldiers and to buy all that white marble for the pavements of Minas Tirith. Outside that, though, it has to be said that Aragorn's need for tax revenue actually seems quite limited. Outside of the capital, we hear of no huge public works projects, road building, expansion of education or public healthcare, and even Gondor's army is probably not all for Aragorn to pay for. Minas Tirith has a garrison of a few thousand, but the bulk of Gondor's forces are from the fiefs, the regions of Gondor. The system seems to be that they answer the call to arms when their king requires it, to go root out a few more orcs, say. It's a bit like the Lord of Winterfell in The Song of Ice and Fire calling the Northern Banners. Aragorn may pay for them while on campaign, but the general upkeep of a Gondor-wide army was not his concern. So governing at a local level was done locally by the fief lords, and most of the army was not Aragorn's to support either. And he also didn't seem to be doing much by way of large public investment projects, once his immediate post-war repair and restoration projects were complete. In reality, his only main ongoing expense seems to have been the upkeep of Minas Tirith, his seat of power, and the cost of his sporadic military campaigns. In modern parlance, we might say that Aragorn operated a small government with a rather federalist approach, allowing the fiefs to largely run themselves. This isn't unexpected in Middle-earth. Tolkien specifically tells us in the prologue to The Lord of the Rings that the Shire had little in the way of government, with families largely managing their own affairs. The mayor there of Micheldelving was the chief official. There was a message service for post and a dozen sheriffs to keep order and round up loose cattle, but that was pretty much it. And in the wider world, it's noticeable that when we follow the stories of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, there may be occasional references to officialdom or money counters. Dale and Lake Town appear to be the biggest offenders in that way, but there is little in the way of infrastructure for levying taxes, toll bridges or customs officials or anything like that. You get the occasional mention that you might think of, but our heroes travelled extensively across the land without really having to open their purses for officialdom at all. Middle-earth is a collection of generally medieval-style agrarian or sometimes feudal societies, local and self-sufficient, and without a state religion demanding tithes. Direct taxation is not a big thing here. Aragorn did need to collect an income as king, but a lot of this will have come directly from income from Minas Tirith's land, which he owned, rather than direct from individuals across the kingdom. They will be more likely to pay their dues to their local lords, who will in turn pass on some to their king. In addition to which, we do have to take account of the seismic changes that happened in Middle-earth during Aragorn's reign. The elves left the continent, presumably leaving many of their treasures behind. Aragorn marrying Arwen was not just a wonderful love story, he was marrying into riches, the daughter of Elrond and Rivendell. In those days, a king's personal fortune was often indistinguishable from their kingdoms. So although we don't have a definitive answer from Tolkien himself as to what Aragorn's tax policy was, it seems very likely that he operated a small state, low tax system, funded from personal inheritance, some small fines, income from his lands around Minas Tirith, and his fief lords. Very few people will have paid him tax direct. It would be incorrect to try to describe the Middle-earth economy in modern terms, because it seems to have operated very differently. But broadly speaking, Aragorn's domestic policy was one of conservative, with a small c, laissez-faire localism, keeping established structures in place, but freeing individuals from much of the direct costs of running the state. Prosperity was delivered not by central government programmes, but by securing stability and peace, when needed by war, at which point further taxes may have been required, though we don't know, and whenever possible, by maintaining strong friendships with neighbours. The land prospered, we are told. Whether that happened because of or despite of his policies, and whether that makes him a wise leader or not, is a matter for personal judgment. Tolkien's view was that Aragorn was a wise ruler, therefore the land prospered. And that works for me. If you'd like to see more videos on the world of J.R.R. Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings, please click on the link to the playlist on the left of your screen. Or if you'd like to support this channel, thank you. There's a link to my Patreon page on the right of your screen. Thanks for watching. That's all for this time. I'll see you again soon.